Welcome to Talking Beats with me, Daniel Lelchuk. If you like what you hear, I'd love you to give us a 5-star rating on Apple or Spotify, write a review, and if you're so inclined, tell a friend or family member. They might like the show as much as you do. Be sure to visit our website, talkingbeats.com, where you can find much more information about the guests, support the show in various ways, sign up for the newsletter, and be in touch directly with me. As always, the dialogue continues on social media at Talking Beats Podcast. I'm so glad you're here with me. Now, to the conversation. On today's program, intelligence expert and writer Amy Zeigarth. She's been studying U.S. intelligence operations for decades and is director of the Robert and Marion Oster National Security Affairs Fellows Program at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. She's also a senior fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute of International Studies, Political Science at Stanford University, and a contributing writer to The Atlantic. She's the author of a number of books, including The Leading Academic Study of Intelligence Failures Leading Up to the 9/11 Attacks, called Spying Blind, The CIA, the FBI, and the Origins of 9/11, and a book co-written with Condoleezza Rice called Political Risk, How Businesses and Organizations Can Anticipate Global Insecurity. She's just now out with a new book, Spies, Lies, and Algorithms, The History and Future of American Intelligence, in which she describes how technology is empowering new enemies, creating new opportunities, weakening the strong, and strengthening the weak. Where does America fall on the spectrum of countries ill or well prepared for what we know is coming? China is on the rise. Can America meet the coming challenge? To discuss this and much more, I'm thrilled to have Amy Zeigarth with me. I welcome you.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be with you.
How are we doing? How is America doing right now as we begin 2022?
Well, there's good news and bad news. The good news is, you know, we're better than we were in many things since 9/11. So a lot of improvements in intelligence. The bad news is the threat landscape never sleeps. And so I find in the book, and I argue that we're in an adapt or fail moment for U.S. intelligence. So we think about all the technologies changing our world, artificial intelligence, the use of the internet, social media. These things are changing who can collect and analyze intelligence. And so what I find in the book is that the United States is losing its edge. More people can collect and analyze intelligence with their cell phones than ever before. And this is a major challenge for our intelligence agencies.
When you use the word moment, what do you mean? How long is the moment going to last until it's gone?
That's an excellent question. I think this is the moment is a moment to adapt. I think the moment is we have to adapt quickly in the next few years, in the next, say, 2 to 5 years. I think there's an urgency here. In terms of the technological era that we're entering, that's going to last a generation, right? Our kids and grandkids are living with technologies that are changing everything from medicine to warfare. And so that moment is going to last much longer. The intelligence moment for change is really a near-term urgent moment.
Meaning a few years.
Yeah, it's a matter of a few years. So I'll give you an example. So when we think about technologies, how are they changing the spy business? I think of 5 key things. Number one, more threats. Think about all the cyber attacks we're facing on a daily basis, right? So it used to be that nations couldn't attack across vast distances in that way, but that's no longer true. So more threats, more speed, more data, more people who need intelligence to protect the country. Think about voters and election, foreign interference in elections. We need intelligence, right? Tech leaders need intelligence. And then there are more competitors, right? So you think about all the open source or publicly available information there is today, the relatively recent discovery of China's nuclear missile silos, hundreds of missile silos, didn't come from spy agencies, came from open source intelligence and independent researchers making that public. So it's a vast new world.
You describe early in the book, 3 major ways in which U.S. intelligence is being tested. And these involve technology, breakthroughs that we couldn't have foreseen maybe a decade ago or more, a data component of all this, and the secrecy component. Talk to us a bit in detail as you sort of divide it into these three parts. You write sort of challenging American intelligence agencies in profound ways. I don't think you use the word profound lightly.
No, I don't. So when you think about intelligence, it's designed to be done in secret, right? And so secrecy is in the DNA of our intelligence agencies. We have 18 of them. And so when I, a few years ago, did a simulation for my college students at the time I was at UCLA, I had some folks from the Central Intelligence Agency come to class. And the head of public affairs who came with them wouldn't tell me his last name, and he wouldn't give me a business card. This is the head of public affairs. This tells you how much secrecy is ingrained in how these agencies operate. But now we live in a world where so much of the insight we can gain about threats that are around the corner comes from open information. And these intelligence agencies now have to engage with the rest of the unclassified world, right? So giving notification to tech leaders about cyber threats, which we now see public service announcements. It's an unnatural act for secret agencies to engage with the public in this way. So that's when I talk about a profound change. It really goes against 50 years of history and how these agencies have been taught to operate in the shadows.
And indeed, one of these open source platforms that I think everybody's probably a little familiar with would be Google Earth, which is something that, you know, we use if we want to see where the neighbor lives, or if did grandma paint her house recently or something like that. But this is incredibly utilized all over the world. Talk about how Google Earth plays into all of this. It's a seemingly simple technology, right? It's basically photos of, is it everywhere on the planet now?
I'm so glad you asked about that, because we take for granted our ability to see all sorts of things thanks to satellites that are orbiting the Earth. But it used to be not that long ago that that kind of imagery that we get just in our car navigating to our kids' soccer games, that kind of technology was only available from spy satellites, and only classified information could reveal sort of that topographical information. But now spy satellites cost $1 billion a piece, and only superpowers could really had the be able to field them. But now we all have this data at our fingertips. So if you think about, you know, commercial satellite imagery, which is essentially free, right, for all of us to use, or very low cost, can detect things as fine as manhole covers from space, right? That's how good the resolution is of these satellites. And so when you think about things like hurricane response, or what are the Iranians up to with their nuclear weapons program, we can get a lot of that information from just commercial satellites that are going overhead.
One thing that a lot of people wonder about is the way in which we, the public, learn about what's happening in the intelligence world. And obviously, the role of the media plays a huge part. We depend on reporters to dig and to sift through and to bring us some a version of the story. And this is where I just wanted to read a small excerpt from your book in which you talk about straddling the sort of inside and outside world. You write here, it's worth noting that I'm a visitor to the secret world of intelligence, not an inhabitant. Although I've served on the National Security Council staff and advised intelligence officials and policymakers, I've never worked inside an intelligence agency. I am a career academic who has examined spy agencies from the outside, looking at how they have evolved over time, why they have such a hard time adapting to new threats, and how they can improve. I like this line a lot. I often feel like an anthropologist who travels to the far reaches of Washington, D.C. to observe the foreign cultures of a rare and secret clan of people called intelligence officers. Being an outsider has both drawbacks and benefits. On the one hand, I cannot examine what the classified record actually says about pivotal intelligence events. I can only study what happened after the fact. On the other hand, an outsider's perspective can bring healthy skepticism and independence. I'm freer to ask uncomfortable questions and come to unflattering conclusions than an insider would be.
That was one of the parts of the book I spent the most time thinking about and writing drafts and drafts. So you just basically talked about my entire academic career in a paragraph.
So you're glad I picked that to read.
I really am glad you picked that one section. And one of the things that I'm really proud of in this book, it's, you know, I write pretty wonky stuff, but with this book, I wanted very much to have the voices of people on the inside, intelligence officers, come through. So I've spent almost 30 years now. I've interviewed hundreds of intelligence officials. And while I want to look at questions like, how does intelligence work in cyberspace? How does covert action work? What I wanted my students and other readers to see is what it's like to be on the inside of these intelligence agencies. So I asked people in my interviews, when did you tell your kids what you did for a living? What were the ethical challenges that you faced in your jobs in these agencies? What was your best and your worst day in your life? And I really am proud that these voices can come through in this book too.
Talk more about the focus groups that you did at UCLA when you taught there, that you do at Stanford, because I imagine, obviously, if you're dealing with a big lecture class of people, of young people, in this case, you'd be curious to know what they think about intelligence. It's a sort of nebulous field. You talk about how, yeah, everybody's maybe used to having a military family down the street or something, two out of every 10 houses. That was that statistic that you mentioned in the country are our military households. I may be getting that slightly wrong, but anyway, it's a large number. And obviously very few people maybe have a next door neighbor who works in intelligence. So you do these focus groups to gauge a general interest. What did you learn? What kind of things did you ask?
Yeah, one of the great things about being a professor is you get to ask your students lots of questions and find out what they think and what they want to know. And so this book actually started years ago when I taught a class at UCLA, and it was 2009, and there were a lot of intelligence controversies. You might remember there was the Iraq War, there was warrantless wiretapping by the National Security Agency, there were CIA detention and interrogation programs. And so I really thought I was going to get a lot of protesters at this class because intelligence was really, you know, it was more scandals than anything else. And what I was shocked to find on the first day of class was I had no protesters. I had standing room only in the lecture hall. That what I found was that students didn't know anything about U.S. intelligence agencies and they wanted to know more. And so almost sort of on a lark, I thought, well, why don't I poll my students? I had about 100 or so and see what they know and see where they get their information. And what I found was Jack Bauer was their teacher, right? They got their information from spy-themed entertainment. And perhaps the most interesting thing I learned was those students who said they watched a lot of spy-themed entertainment were statistically more likely to approve of waterboarding suspected terrorists. This is a technique that simulates drowning that many regard as torture. They were more willing to approve all sorts of aggressive counterterrorism techniques, statistically more likely than their classmates who didn't watch spy-themed entertainment all the time. And so I started digging into this more and found that spy-themed entertainment really had become adult education. And I found pretty significant influence of spy-themed entertainment on public opinion. And then I also found that many instances where spy-themed entertainment was affecting real policymakers, making real policy decisions based on fictional plot lines that are not realistic.
How could that happen? Give an example. I mean, this sounds absolutely crazy, but this is a fiction in intermingling with reality. And sometimes the line is so blurry, we don't know what's what.
Yeah. So, you know, Tom Clancy had this great line once where he said, the difference between fact and fiction is that fiction has to make sense. So I found, I'll give you a few
which you
examples.
Quote in the book, by the way, at the beginning of a chapter.
Yes. You've read my book very closely. I'm very happy about that. So I found, I'll give you a few examples. So in 2002, a lieutenant colonel at Guantanamo Bay, where we had terrorist detainees, held a brainstorming session about interrogation techniques. And she later said that Jack Bauer from the hit show 24 gave her lots of ideas. In 2009, when Leon Panetta was being nominated to be the director of the CIA, he was asked in his Senate confirmation hearings about a ticking time bomb scenario. You know the plot in the movies where someone's in custody, they think they have information about an imminent terrorist attack. What do you do? This has never happened in real life. Experts have said for years that ticking time bomb scenarios are only the stuff of Hollywood. And the Senate Intelligence Committee spent a lot of time asking Leon Panetta about the ticking time bomb scenario in his real confirmation hearing. And then the movie that gives me the most heartburn, I think, of all, is the movie Zero Dark Thirty. So I'm sure you know that it's the depiction of the 10-year manhunt for Osama bin Laden. The movie claimed to be a, quote, reported film. The movie says in the opening frames it's based on firsthand accounts of actual events, but it's a work of fiction. But when the movie came out, it was so confusing about what was real and what wasn't that the acting director of the CIA had to write a memo to the CIA workforce talking about how this movie was not reality. So when the head of the CIA has to debunk a movie to the CIA, you know entertainment isn't just entertainment anymore.
Take us back a little ways, because I was surprised to learn that indeed intelligence has not been happening all through America's history, that sort of peacetime intelligence is a relatively new phenomenon since the end of the Second World War. You articulate that it was only after the war that we had permanent and robust, to use your word, intelligence operations. Talk more about this and articulate what we were doing before then. How well were we getting along?
So compared to other countries, the history of our intelligence agencies is really short. The Chinese had been doing intelligence for 2,000 years before intelligence really figured into the Revolutionary War. And so what I found in my favorite period of history is early American history. George Washington was actually quite a good spy master. So in the early days of the Revolutionary War, intelligence played a pivotal role in deceiving the British, in hiding our troops and the weaknesses that we had. And then something strange happened. After George Washington left the presidency, intelligence pretty much floundered for the next couple hundred years. And part of that was America's role in the world, right? We were focused on nation building at home, not engaging in entangling alliances and European politics. And part of it was this aversion to standing armies and an aversion to having a standing intelligence capacity. So the CIA wasn't created until 1947, and it was really created in a response to Pearl Harbor, right? Never again was the idea after Pearl Harbor. We needed one agency to centralize intelligence. So lots of different parts of the military, the State Department, and other agencies were collecting information, but nobody put it together in time to stop Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941. And so the CIA's mandate was to prevent another strategic surprise by coordinating intelligence, which hadn't been done very well. But that was a relatively new development for the United States compared to, say, the British, who had repelled foreign invasions three times in that several hundred years using intelligence. So we're relative newcomers to this business.
Talk about your early beginnings in all of this. How does one become a spy historian slash influencer of the conversation about what we as Americans should be thinking about, should be concerned about, which is another thing I'd like to talk about when it comes to all of this. But, is it a normal thing for a kid to wake up at 8:05 and say, I want to do that? Or
it is definitely not normal. I really came at it by accident. So I grew up in Kentucky. I started taking Chinese lessons as a kid. I thought I wanted to study Chinese foreign policy. And then I got really interested in the American side of American foreign policy. And I ended up going to grad school and I was working on the National Security Council staff. And what fascinated me was information. How does the president get information? What kind of information does the president get? And how does that flow work? So I came back to Stanford. I was writing my PhD dissertation and I said, I want to write my dissertation on the National Security Council staff and how information gets to the president. And my PhD advisor at the time, who was Condi Rice, said, that's a terrible topic. You can't write a dissertation on that. It's not interesting enough in terms of explaining the outcome. You shouldn't look at one organization. You should explain differences across organizations and what led to those differences. It's a good political science topic. So I went back to the library and I was digging around and I found this law, the National Security Act of 1947. And lo and behold, that law created most of the major national security organizations in our government today, including the Joint Chiefs of Staff and this little known agency at the time that was all but forgotten in congressional debates called the CIA. And so I stumbled into the CIA for my PhD dissertation. I ended up not writing another thing about the National Security Council, which started me on this journey. And once I started looking at the CIA, I was hooked. Who doesn't like spies, right? So there's a natural interest, I think, in how espionage works. But what kept me focused on intelligence for all these years is intelligence analysts have to think about how they think. They're solving really hard puzzles all the time, and that fascinates me. And I also think they're such a crucial input to foreign policy that most people never know about. We don't have intelligence officials boarding airplanes first. We don't have flybys at NFL games for intelligence officers. They serve in secret. And that interested me. So it was maybe not the wisest career move to try to get data about secret agencies as an academic, but it's been wonderful and really fascinating.
You know, you have a chapter in here, chapter six, you're talking about counterintelligence in here. And it's a very actually like spy. Counterintelligence is a very sort of sexy word, unlike civics, which is another C word that we talk about on here, which is decidedly not sexy sounding, at least.
Yet it is. It's very important.
yet it is. Yes. Absolutely, as we talk about often here. But talk about counterintelligence. You say the art of countering the intelligence activities of others. Okay, well, sounds good and well. What is this all about? And how is the complexities of AI, of changing technology, of this sort of wild west of a digital age affecting how counterintelligence is practiced?
So counterintelligence is, I think, one of those topics where the movies and sort of our fascination really peak, right? So it really consists of two things. One is, how do you protect your own stuff? So, you know, the National Security Agency has all sorts of capabilities, including special windows to prevent eavesdropping by foreign intelligence services. So it's a lot of the secured facilities part. But counterintelligence also has an offensive side. How do we penetrate a foreign intelligence agency to better understand what they're trying to steal from us? So it is a spy versus spy kind of world. There's an old saying in the intelligence business that it takes a mole to catch a mole, and that's often true. And so when we think about counterintelligence now, how do you stop the bad guys from penetrating your own information, your own people, and how do you penetrate theirs? It's all getting faster and bigger. So one of the most damaging moles in American history is a guy named Robert Hansen. He worked for the FBI for 25 years. He looked like he was a model citizen. He was, you know, a devout religious guy. He was a good dad, but he was a traitor. And it turns out he was stealing secrets and passing them to the Soviets and then the Russians for almost his entire FBI career. But he had to do it sort of one small garbage bag at a time. So it took him years to smuggle out 6,000 documents that he passed to the Russians. Fast forward to today, Edward Snowden was able to download millions of pages of documents, really highly classified programs, within a matter of months. So the scale of damage that moles or traitors, whatever you want to call them, can inflict on the country is much greater now than it was in the Cold War. And it's also easier for foreign intelligence services to blow our own networks of human assets on the ground by penetrating the technological tools we use to try to communicate with them, which is what is reported to have happened in China a few years ago. All of our assets in China were blown, many of them killed, others of them imprisoned. And as what's been publicly reported is it was a problem in a firewall of a communication system used to communicate with some of them that led the Chinese to figure out who they were.
Talk more about Snowden, if you would, because he's a figure that comes up some in the book. And I know that's not the point of the book, but he is such a popular and well-known name In America, an infamous name, hated by many people, admired by few, I would say. Absolutely controversial, but every American is probably familiar with the name. What did he do exactly? How did he do it? What kind of moral implications do you think come along with what he did? Certainly for many, including myself, a very not heroic figure.
I would agree with you. I recognize that for some people, Edward Snowden is a whistleblower and a hero. For me, not so much. When I brought Mike Hayden, the former CIA and NSA director, to Stanford, I asked him, I said, "General Hayden, if Edward Snowden were here today and you could ask or say anything to him, what would you say?" And without missing a beat, Mike Hayden said, "You have the right to remain silent." Right? So why do I say that Edward Snowden is a traitor? Well, first of all, he took an oath and he had a security clearance and he violated that security clearance. And we take those security clearances seriously because they, when they're violated, they can do serious damage to the country. He didn't just download things that he came across because he was interested in privacy. He went out and socially engineered, convinced his colleagues to give him access to their data, and trolled around gathering all sorts of information about very highly classified programs, our surveillance capabilities abroad, by the way, which were legal, right? He didn't uncover any illegality. And where did he go with that information? He went to Hong Kong and then he went to Moscow. So there have been bipartisan examinations of the damage that Edward Snowden has done to this country, and the damage was grave. This isn't just Republicans talking, it's Democrats and Republicans together. So he did grave damage to our national security. He damaged the trust between US and our allies. By the way, allies do spy on each other with rare exception. So when we hear complaints by our European friends that they're shocked that the United States was actually gathering data on them, they do the same thing to us. So there's a little disingenuousness there. But Snowden, perhaps most importantly, damaged trust with the American people, and he damaged trust with companies in Silicon Valley, where I live. And companies in the Valley have to collaborate with the U.S. government today, because when we think about things like foreign election interference and cyber threats, it's not just the government that is responsible for protecting us. They have to collaborate with private sector companies. And that was a huge problem after the Snowden revelations, was this trust deficit with companies like Google and Facebook and others in Silicon Valley.
How would you contrast him with a figure like Assange, Julian Assange?
Well, I think of Julian Assange as more of the middleman who just wants to sort of throw salt in everybody's faces. Julian Assange didn't take an oath to protect the country. He didn't have a security clearance. What he did was illegal and wrong, but Edward Snowden betrayed his country. I think there's a bit, he was put in a position of trust to protect this nation, and he violated that most sacred trust.
Clearly, you have the opinion that more Americans should be informed about intelligence, should have some basic understanding of what our agencies do, what they're trying to do, other than sort of the generic, well, keep us safe, keep our borders safe, keep our buildings intact, keep our computer systems safe from being hacked. But beyond that, why do you think it's important for the everyday American to think about this in addition to the 2,000 other things that we all should be informed about? Well, why is this so crucial, you think, as we face an ever split, ever divided, even more violently polarized society? Is this something we could even unify around somehow?
I hope so. I mean, I think about really three reasons why it matters. The first is the sexy topic you mentioned before, civics, right? Which is that, you know, it's important for Americans to know about the organizations that are working for them, even if they're secret. There's always a tension between secrecy of intelligence and accountability in democracy. And members of Congress have to have an incentive to pay attention to make sure our intelligence is accountable and that it's effective. And the way that members of Congress care is if voters care. And voters can't care if they don't know. So the civics part of this, I think, is incredibly important. if voters don't understand well how the intelligence business works, and they're not incentivizing members of Congress to learn about how the intelligence business works, then excesses of our intelligence community are more likely to go unchecked. So there's more likely to be abuse, and weaknesses are more likely to not get fixed. So there's a civics component, I think, is point number one. Point number two is, I'm amazed at how many students think that intelligence is political, that intelligence agencies have a role in policy, that they make policy or have an axe to grind. And that is not true. Intelligence is apolitical, like the military, and it has to be. If intelligence is viewed as a political tool of one administration or another, then we as a country won't trust information that's guiding policy. So I think that's a second thing that's really important. It's nonpartisan, it's apolitical. And then the third piece is, intelligence actually affects us much more than it ever has. So if you're a tech company leader, or you're in the financial services industry, or you're in the power or water industry, you own and operate critical infrastructure that is ground zero for cyber warfare today. And you have to work with intelligence agencies in order to protect your own businesses, to protect your own vote, to protect your own country. And so we have to interact with these agencies more now. And in order to do that well, we have to do it from a place of knowledge and trust, not myth and suspicion.
Myth and suspicion, these are two hard things to get around, because as you know, especially you talk about social media on here, with the preponderance of Americans getting information from social media, digging up myths, having their friend or friend on social media send them some statement that's some myth or some made up thing that turns out to be came from nowhere, or maybe came from a troll farm in Russia or something like that. It's very difficult to get around all of this. Well, I'll put it this way. You seem to feel that we are behind, but how many more people like you sounding the alarm do we need until we're going to have some major action? How many more books like this one, which is wonderful, are we going to need until what, Congress, until Silicon Valley? Or are the wires crossed too much, so to speak, right now?
So I think there's a growing awareness of the need for our intelligence agencies to be reformed to meet this moment. I'm not the first person to point this out. And I think there are a number of people, both inside the government and former senior intelligence officials, who are now arguing the same thing. So I'm encouraged by that. And I know many inside the CIA, the NSA, and other three-letter agencies are trying to adopt new technologies to do a better job. But Congress is the most dysfunctional element of our intelligence system today. There are more powdered milk experts in Congress than intelligence experts in Congress. It's a shocking statistic. I was shocked when I found it, but it's true.
Powdered milk.
The dairy caucus is actually larger than the number of people in Congress who have ever worked in an intelligence agency before.
And you say that about doctors too, which I would believe, but I didn't know about the powdered milk. Okay, we'll add that to the list.
So when powdered milk has more expertise than intelligence in Congress, you know we have a problem. And here's the amazing thing. Congress has actually tied its own hands to prevent the development of expertise. So in the House, members of the Intelligence Committee have term limits, which means just when they understand how this 18-agency world works, they have to get off the committee. So if you have a congressional committee where members aren't expert, it's little wonder that they're not asking the right questions. So intelligence reform has to start with congressional reform so that members of Congress have better incentives to develop expertise and ask the important questions.
Just pause here for 1 second. Is it so difficult? Does it take more time because this is such a foreign subject to Congress people? Is that what it is, that it takes years to understand what questions to ask, that by the time you understand what questions to ask, your time on the committee is over? Is it as simple as that?
That's a big part of it. So all of us, you know, do more of the things we're rewarded for doing and do less of the things we're not rewarded for doing. And from an election standpoint, intelligence is a loser for members of Congress. Nobody votes for their member of Congress based on their views on intelligence. The intelligence committees have to operate most of the time in secret. So members can't even talk about what they do back in the district. They don't bring pork back to the district based on their service on the intelligence committees. And so it's really an act of patriotism for those members who really do put a lot of time into it. They have to learn on the job. It takes a lot of time, and they have to do their homework in secured facilities, right? These are separate facilities from their offices that are locked. They can't bring their staffers with them. So it's much harder for them to actually do that kind of homework, and they don't get rewarded for doing it. Some members spend, I want to be clear, some members of Congress really are dedicated public servants, but most are not when it comes to intelligence because they don't get rewarded for voters for doing it.
Who comes to mind when you think of people who are outliers, who are really doing a great job, who see this, who take it seriously? What Congress people on either side of the aisle stand out to you as being people to emulate on this front?
I think if you look, I'm trying to find some good news story and an otherwise bad news plot line. The Senate Intelligence Committee today is still bipartisan. And so you look at Senator Mark Warner and Senator Marco Rubio, they don't agree on a whole lot, but they're working together on the Senate Intelligence Committee, and they do take their oversight role seriously. Congressman Adam Schiff has devoted a lot of time to becoming an expert in intelligence. And there are some who have stood out in history on the House side, Congressman Mike Rogers and Congressman Dutch Ruppersberger. Also, different parties didn't agree on much, but worked together. They're the outliers, though. And I will say, you know, again, I'm not the first to point out congressional dysfunction. The 9/11 Commission called congressional oversight dysfunctional. And it was so bad oversight that in 2007, the Senate Intelligence Committee held an oversight hearing about itself. Right? Why are we so bad? And how can we do a better job? So you know oversight is problematic when members of the Oversight Committee say we're not doing such a good job.
What humility.
At least they were asking for help.
You know, everybody on this program has to talk a little bit about music because it is called Talking Beats after all. That is my background since age 4 and a half being a cellist. So, Amy Zegart, I'm curious to you, what is music? It is, as I call it, the great unifier. We can be D's, R's, and in the middle and all love a Beethoven symphony at the same time. So what is music to you? And has music in the pandemic been playing a large role, an outsized role?
Music to me is family. So I know you didn't know this, but now I'm going to reveal my secret past, which is my grandmother was a concert pianist. And she grew up and was in an all-women's band in the 30s that traveled around the East Coast. And so I grew up with her playing piano all the time. And so my fondest memories, it's like my comfort food, is when I think about my grandmother playing piano just for us. So music has always played that role for me. I would hasten to add that her musical talents did not come to me. So I am not a talented musician by any stretch.
So many people seem to say that, but maybe you just didn't practice hard enough as a little kid. Reading spy novels could be, I'm not sure.
As political scientists say, it's overdetermined. So many variables explain why I'm bad at music, but I do love it. And I when I think about it, I get sort of a warm and fuzzy feeling about my family and the role it played in my childhood.
Was this an all-women's band based in Kentucky, or where was it?
It was not based in Kentucky. It was based out of Boston. And I discovered when I visited my grandmother, who at the time was in her 80s, she revealed to me, which she had never revealed to anyone in the family, that she fell in love with the bass player of the Glenn Miller band and was going to elope with him. But her parents dragged her back and told her that she couldn't. And I'm grateful for that because otherwise I wouldn't be here.
Well, that's true, although maybe you'd have some better musical genes. I don't know.
That's true.
I wonder what your students who are following along with this book, you have a class that goes along with this book, I wonder what your students are saying. Are they overwhelmed? Are they confused? We haven't talked much about China. I imagine a lot of them I've been to China, played, I think, in 11 different cities in mainland China. No, nothing recently. I probably won't be there for a long time. But I have some experience there in mainland China. Obviously, in classical music, there's lots and lots of Chinese colleagues we have everywhere in the world. What are your students confused about? What do they think about all this? What is their opinion of China? And is China eating our lunch, as General McMaster told me recently?
I wouldn't say there's one considered view among students. So I'm teaching a course right now, and there are 24 students in the class, and they come from 9 different countries. So we have a Chinese student in the class. We have 2 South Koreans in the class. I have a Ukrainian student in the class who's watching Russian troops massing outside the border, and it's personal to her. So one of the things that I love about teaching at Stanford is I have students from everywhere with lots of different perspectives, and they share those different perspectives. And so there isn't one point of view. But I do think there is a growing realization that great power competition is back, that Russia and China are much more rivals and competitors than we thought they were. And I, you know, and H.R. McMaster is a colleague of mine, and we talk about this too. We can't be naive about the world in which we live. And so I think there's real concern. If I had to think about what unites my students, I'd say 2 things. One is concern about where geopolitics is headed with this competition between the US, China, and Russia. And the second is climate change. So I poll the students, and then I also poll military fellows who I work with about their night frights, what keeps them up at night. And students care put climate change really high on the list. More so than probably people of my generation. And so that's interesting to me. And I think it's, obviously we're now all living in the grip of climate change, but it's the man-made threats of, not that climate change isn't man-made, but the adversarial threats, right? The climate can't react to what you're doing in the same way that Xi Jinping or Vladimir Putin can. And so I think it's both of those categories of threats that worry them, and they want to do something about it. Right. My students are a self-selected group. They take my class because they already care about these issues. So I'm not reaching the students that don't care about these issues.
Well, last night at 2:30 in the morning when I woke up, I was kept up by visions of the final scene of the opera Carmen, which was haunting me. So that's where I was. I had the music and the text in French swirling around my head, and I couldn't go back to sleep because of that. But maybe tonight it'll be climate change.
If that's a welcome change for you, what an interesting life you lead.
Trust. We talk about trust in our agencies, and this is a common theme that has come up on this podcast a lot with people from Center for Strategic and International Studies, with Richard Haas, various people. We talk about what kind of a democracy we need to have is so related to public trust in our institutions, that the strength of the democracy, not only in my amateur opinion, is informed by how well connected the populace, the electorate, is to what's going on, but also in the electorate's trust that voting is secure, that the courts are to be trusted. That the big institutions that we as Americans think about and grow up with are to be taken seriously and trusted. The intelligence apparatus in this country, I am 32 years old, so I was very young when Iraq was happening, the war in Iraq, and I remember the parade of intelligence officials, and certainly remember the lead up and all of that. It damaged my and many others in my generation ability to trust the intelligence apparatus of this country, and understandably so. I think we're still rebuilding from Iraq, aren't we, in a sense? Are we ever going to get away from that and get back to trusting in the institutions in the way that we hopefully should, so they can operate effectively?
I hope so. I mean, I think when we think about, and Iraq, WMD was an intelligence failure, no question about it. 9/11 was an intelligence failure. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't trust our intelligence agencies, that they're trying to do the best that they can. They're never going to get it right 100% of the time. And so trust doesn't mean they're perfect, right? I do this exercise with my students where I say, you know, imagine that you're trying to anticipate what you're going to do for your summer vacation. You're going to write it down on a piece of paper. We're going to come back a year from now and see if you did what you said you were going to do. How many of you are actually going to take the summer vacation that you said you were going to do? And invariably people say, oh yeah, that probably won't happen. And there are all these reasons why. And then I say, well, now imagine your job is you're not predicting you. That's the easy case. You can't even predict yourself 6 months from now. Now imagine you have to predict what the student sitting next to you is going to do. That's harder, right? And now imagine they're trying to deceive you and hide from you what their real plans are. That's what our intelligence agencies have to do. And so they're never going to get it 100% right. But I do think that we can and are rebuilding trust with our intelligence agencies. And I think a big part of that is for the American public to get a better sense of who these people are and what is it that they do. And when they fail, are they thinking systematically about why they fail? One of the chapters in the book talks about cognitive bias and how, and the mental shortcuts we all use that lead all of us astray. And intelligence officials are fall victim to the same kind of biases that lead NFL fans to overpredict how well their favorite team is going to do, right? That's optimism bias. So there are a number of recurring cognitive traps that we fall into that explain why our intelligence community often doesn't get it as right as they should. They're human.
We have all of this stuff, all of this material we're going to be thinking about. We've talked about what keeps me up at night, what keeps your students up at night, what keeps you up at night.
What keeps me up at night is something you mentioned earlier, which is the polarization of our country. I think this is a moment of fragility for our democracy. I think about January 6th, the first violent transfer of power in American history, right? That's disturbing. That a large majority of Republicans still think Joe Biden is not legitimately elected president, that's disturbing. That's on the right. I see this polarization, this denigration of the democratic process. And on the left, I see a narrative of self-loathing, that America should be ashamed, that we are a bad country. And I think that's tearing us apart as well. And, you know, just last week, Jim Mattis, General Mattis, who was Secretary of Defense, came to speak to my students, and he said something that really struck me. He said, just because we're not a perfect country, and we aren't perfect, doesn't mean we're not worth fighting for. And so I worry about the fragmentation of our democratic society, our lack of unity, our polarization, our divisions. And that makes us incredibly vulnerable to foreign powers that want to exacerbate those tensions and polarize us more and show the weakness of the democratic model for the world and the relative strength of the state authoritarianism model, like in Russia or in China. And so the biggest threat to the United States is the United States. And that's what keeps me up at night.
Is there a way out?
I think so. I think the way out is to have these kinds of conversations. It's to have political leaders with courage that believe that most people come from a good place, that we may disagree and we should disagree, but we don't have malevolent intent. And I think a lot of that starts in university classrooms, where we challenge our students to be uncomfortable, to encounter ideas that they may not agree with, but they do it in a respectful way, in a way that we learn from each other, that learning is an act of community. And so I think in many places, universities have moved to the wrong model, where no student should ever feel uncomfortable about encountering views different from their own. I think it's the exact opposite. I want my students to experience views that are different from their own in a respectful and safe manner, but I want them to grapple and challenge themselves and learn from each other.
Well, I think that's a good place to call it, and we'll think about that and many other things. And it is important, I think, that you highlighted the fact that, yes, we need to broaden out if we are to have a society that can really function. We need to have students hearing opinions that aren't exactly theirs, because after all, that's the main reason I think people go to universities, to have their mind broadened. I mean, I guess maybe to get a job guarantee in certain fields, but I think people want to be challenged, or I thought. at least I do on a daily basis. I'm a young person, not university age, but I can't imagine how boring life would be if the only people with whom I interacted felt exactly the same as I do. It would be extremely boring, not to mention bad for my own brain.
Yeah. I mean, I try to practice what I preach. I always tell my students, you know, when I assign, and I will be assigning this book, I also assign people who disagree with me. I want them to read the toughest criticisms of my own work, because nobody has all the answers. But I think, you know, we can each play a role in mending the fabric of our democracy, whether it's talking to your neighbor, whether it's teaching about articles, the people that disagree with you, or whether it's playing the cello that in a way that really moves people.
Amy Zeigart, Spies, Lies, and Algorithms, holding it right here, The History and Future of American Intelligence. Great pleasure indeed. I thank you.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to Talking Beats with me, Daniel Lalchuk. Don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and write a review if you would. That really helps. The original music for this show is by Ronald Markham. The producer is Doug Christian. For more information, visit the website of the show, talkingbeats.com. Thank you for listening. This is Talking Beats with Daniel Lalchuk.